The older civilizations created tradition and lived by tradition. Today, the power of tradition is destroyed. The body of our state is civilization still, but its spirit is the spirit of the nomadic world. It's the spirit of the great plains and the high seas. So that it's difficult to resist the persuasion that so soon as one law runs in the earth and the fierceness of frontiers ceases to distress us, that urgency in our nature that stirs us in spring and autumn to be up and travelling will have its way with us. We shall obey the call of the summer pastures and the winter pastures in our blood, the call of the mountains, the desert, and the sea. For some of us also, who may be of a different lineage, there's the call of the forest, and there are those who would hunt in the summer and return to the fields for the harvest and the plough. But this doesn't mean that men will have become homeless and all adrift. The normal nomadic life is not a homeless one, but a movement between homes. The Kalmuks today, like the swallows, go yearly 1,000 miles from one home to another. The beautiful and convenient cities of the coming age, we conclude, will have their seasons when they will be full of life, and seasons when they will seem asleep. Life will ebb and flow to and from every region seasonally, as the interest of that region rises or declines. There'll be little drudgery in this better ordered world. Natural power harnessed in machines will be the general drudge. What drudgery is inevitable will be done as a service and duty for a few years or months out of each life. It won't consume nor degrade the whole life of anyone. And not only drudges, but many other sorts of men and ways of living, which loom large in the current social scheme, will necessarily have dwindled in importance or passed away altogether. There'll be few professional fighting men, or none at all. No custom house officers. The increased multitude of teachers will have abolished large police forces and large jail staffs. Madhouses will be rare or non-existent. A worldwide sanitation will have diminished the proportion of hospitals, nurses, sick room attendants, and the like. A worldwide economic justice, the floating population of cheats, sharpers, gamblers, forestallers, parasites, and speculators generally. But there'll be no diminution of adventure or romance in this world of the days to come. Sea fisheries and the incessant insurrection of the sea, for example, will call for their own stalwart types of men. The high air will clamour for manhood, the deep and dangerous secret places of nature. Men will turn again with renewed interest to the animal world. In these disordered days, a stupid, uncontrollable massacre of animal species goes on. From certain angles of vision, it's a thing almost more tragic than human miseries. In the 19th century, dozens of animal species, and some of them very interesting species, were exterminated, and one of the first fruits of an effective world state would be the better protection of what are now wild beasts. It's a strange thing in human history to note how little has been done since the Bronze Age in taming, using, befriending, and appreciating the animal life about us. But that mere witless killing which is called sport today would inevitably give place, in a better educated world community, to a modification of the primitive instincts that find expression in this way, changing them into an interest not in the deaths, but in the lives of beasts, and leading to fresh and perhaps very strange and beautiful attempts to befriend these pathetic, kindred, lower creatures we no longer fear as enemies, hate as rivals, or need as slaves. And a world state and universal justice doesn't mean the imprisonment of our race in any bleak institutional orderliness. There'll still be mountains and the sea. There'll be jungles and great forests, cared for indeed and treasured and protected. The great plains will still spread before us, and the wild winds blow. But men won't hate so much, fear so much, nor cheat so desperately, and they'll keep their minds and bodies cleaner. There are unhopeful prophets who see in the gathering together of men into one community the possibility of violent race conflicts for ascendancy, But that's to suppose that civilization is incapable of adjustments by which men of different qualities and temperaments and appearances will live side by side, following different roles and contributing diverse gifts. The weaving of mankind into one community doesn't imply the creation of a homogeneous community, but rather the reverse. The welcome and the adequate utilization of distinctive quality in an atmosphere of understanding. It's the almost universal bad manners of the present age which makes race intolerable to race. The community to which we may be moving will be more mixed, which doesn't necessarily mean more interbred, more various, and more interesting than any existing community. Communities all to one pattern, like boxes of toy soldiers, are things of the past rather than the future. But one of the hardest, most impossible tasks a writer can set himself is to picture the life of people better educated, happier in their circumstances, more free and more healthy than he is himself. We know enough today to know that there is infinite room for betterment in every human concern. Nothing is needed but collective effort. Our poverty, our restraints, our infections and indigestions, our quarrels and misunderstandings, are all things controllable and removable by concerted human action. But we know as little how life would feel without them as some poor, dirty, ill-treated, fierce-souled creature born and bred amidst the cruel and dingy surroundings of a European back street can know what it is to bathe every day, always to be clad beautifully, to climb mountains for pleasure, to fly, to meet none but agreeable, well-mannered people, to conduct researches or make delightful things. Yet a time when all such good things will be for all men may be coming more nearly than we think. Each one who believes that brings the good time nearer. Each heart that fails delays it. One can't foretell the surprises or disappointments the future has in store. Before this chapter of the world state can begin fairly in our histories, other chapters, as yet unsuspected, may still need to be written, as long and as full of conflict as our account of the growth and rivalries of the great powers. There may be tragic economic struggles, grim grapplings of race with race and class with class. It may be that private enterprise will refuse to learn the lesson of service without some quite catastrophic revolution, and that a phase of confiscation and amateurish socialistic government lies before us. We don't know. We can't tell. These are unnecessary disasters, but they may be unavoidable disasters. Human history becomes more and more a race between education and catastrophe. Against the unifying effort of Christendom, and against the unifying influence of the mechanical revolution, catastrophe won, at least to the extent of achieving the Great War. We can't tell yet how much of the winnings of catastrophe still remain to be gathered in. New falsities may arise and hold men in some unrighteous and fated scheme of order for a time before they collapse amidst the misery and slaughter of generations. Yet, clumsily or smoothly, the world, it seems, progresses, and will progress. In this outline, in our account of Paleolithic man, we've borrowed a description from Mr. Worthington Smith of the very highest life in the world some 50,000 years ago. It was a bestial life. We've sketched, too, the gathering for a human sacrifice some 15,000 years ago. That scene, again, is almost incredibly cruel to a modern civilized reader. Yet it isn't more than 500 years since the great empire of the Aztecs still believed that it could live only by the shedding of blood. Every year in Mexico, hundreds of human victims died in this fashion. The body was bent like a bow over the curved stone of sacrifice. The breast was slashed open with a knife of obsidian, and the priest tore out the beating heart of the still-living victim. The day may be close at hand when we shall no longer tear out the hearts of men, even for the sake of our national gods. Let the reader but refer to the earlier time charts we've given in this history, and he'll see the true measure and transitoriness of all the conflicts, deprivations, and miseries of this present period of painful and yet hopeful change. This concludes the reading of The Outline of History by H. G. Wells. The book was read by Bernard Mays. If you'd like to receive a free catalogue listing our complete line of audiobooks, write us at Post Box 969, Ashland, Oregon, zip code 97520, or call toll-free 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665.